I'm Jeff Jackson. I'm with PA Consulting Engineers, and Conrad is here on my left. The way that we've kind of broken up the presentation today is we're going to start off and we're going to talk about actually the systems themselves, get into a little bit about some of the financial performance metrics, some of the issues that you'll need to address and think about when you're looking at these systems for particular projects. And then Brandon will get up actually and give us a presentation about incentives, also talking about third-party financing models, and also some of the recent regulation changes that we've seen. And we'll follow up at the end with a Q&A session. So what we're gonna start off with is we're gonna start off with the big broad picture of why renewables, why are we beginning to see these on projects, and what's driving them in the marketplace. And then we'll get into some of the software tools and analysis methods that we use when we're looking at these particular systems for projects. Then we'll actually dive into the systems, and I'll kind of start and dive into some of the electrical and combined heat and power systems, and then Conrad will go into some of the thermal or heat energy systems, and then we'll follow up, I guess, with Brandon talking about incentives. So the big picture, what's driving all these together, is just really we're kind of seeing three elements that are driving renewable systems. The first is basically marketplace. And when we're talking about marketplace, what we're talking about is the value that we're beginning to see put on buildings and that are sustainable. But it's also the marketplace that's driving it in terms of, as you're seeing more of these systems getting on projects, the manufacturing costs are coming down. There's a greater knowledge base and people can do them. And what you're finding is the actual driving the cost of these systems down. One of the other elements is social responsibility. You're seeing that in terms of the marketing aspect, that companies are wanting to be known as earth-friendly or sustainable companies. And then the final element is regulation, which basically ties into things like renewable portfolio standards that drive a certain amount of the production for utilities to renewables, and also into regulation that actually we've had a pretty active session that Brandon will get into, encouraging development of renewables on projects. So on software tools, when we're talking about from the power generation side of things, there's really three tools that we typically use when we're looking at a project. One is Homer, which is an NREL developed product. It's platform independent, meaning that you don't have to have Excel or one of those other type software programs for it to run. Then you have RetScreen, which was a Canadian developed product. And it's kind of a souped up version of Excel. They've got some fancy databases tied into it. And both of those are the more robust programs that we use when we're looking at systems. They can take you from pre-design all the way through design. Then PV Watts is kind of a more simplistic estimator when you're looking at solar systems in particular. It's great for when you just kind of want to do a quick dive in and get an idea of how much annual energy production a particular system might produce.
RetScreen is actually a suite of software. There's micro hydro, wind, ground source heat pumps, and others. We use it also for doing preliminary passes at geothermal systems, just getting pre-design information together to see whether the systems make sense for your project. A couple other products we use is eQuest and Energy Plus. They're full building simulation programs. The importance of these programs is trying to really get the accurate loads. We want net loads. We don't necessarily want design loads that we're going to pick. Similar to a trace load 700 or some program like that. We actually want the net load so we can pick the systems on the most accurate size. GeoLoop, or Glee Pro, is a vertical ground source heat pump system software. We use that a lot for sizing vertical well arrangements.
So one of the other things that about the RetScreen and the Homer as well is that both of those programs actually give you, they have a financial package built into them. So you can kind of use those to begin to look at the finances and do sensitivity analysis on that.
One thing interesting about those programs, I think all except for two of them are freeware too. You don't have to necessarily pay to use them.
So for electrical generation systems, we're going to hit on photovoltaics, biomass, biofuels, and biogas. Of those, we're probably going to focus more on the biomass and the biogas because those are some of the newer technologies that people aren't as familiar with the photovoltaics and the biofuels being a little bit more in the consciousness and what people are seeing in the thermal.
The thermal systems we're going to talk about are primarily biomass water heating and geothermal heating and cooling. We're going to touch on solar water heating a little bit. But I think there's been quite a few presentations on solar water heating systems, so we're not going to focus on that too much.
All right, so let's dive in. So on photovoltaics, these pictures up here that you're seeing are actually of the Willamette University Kaneko Commons project. And these actually aren't all the PV on the project. These are what I would describe as the marketing PV of the project. So when you get into designing PV for buildings, you're almost always going to end up in a situation where there's going to be a certain amount of the PV that you're going to want to bring down, you're going to make highly visible, people are going to want to see it. When you do that, more often than not, it tends to drive down the efficiency and the energy production of the system itself. So it has a value from that socially responsible communicating to your client, to your people who are coming to your site, but it doesn't have as much energy generation. So what you end up doing typically is you have a mixture of workhorse PV, typically that's on the roof, it's oriented optimally for the sun, and that's generating the bulk of your energy production, and then you'll take a certain portion of that down and put that invisible element so that people can see it and experience it, and it becomes a statement of sustainable or green design. In this particular situation, that's actually a balcony that the students can walk out on, and they can look up at these panels. They can also look down at those panels and see and experience the photovoltaic system as it's operating. And as a part of this system as well, they also had a digital display put in one of the corridors so you can see the energy that the system's producing. So when we talk about PV types, typically you're going to see PV broken into really two types, and I've added one, which was the combined heat and power PV. But typically it's thin film and then crystalline or modular-based systems. The crystalline modules are the most common. Those are the panels that most people are familiar with. That's what we see right here. And you're going to find a greater base of people who are familiar and have worked with those systems. The thin film systems are those are the ones that you see in applications like standing seam roofs or PV glazing. You can actually get some of the crystalline systems integrated into the glazing, but more often than not, most times when you see the PV and it kind of looks almost like window tinting, that's the thin film application. So with thin film, it's definitely an up and coming portion of the market, but it's got the attribute, the downside of it's not as energy efficient, so you need more of it. So economics, PV is definitely incentive driven in order to make the paybacks work out. So what you'll find is when you look at a project, you need to find out where it is. And if you're working in Oregon, good, that's awesome. We've got really good incentives here. But you go to some other states, that's not always the case. Some states like New Jersey, California, Oregon are some examples of states that have got some pretty good solar incentives. The other element is this little piece of art right here, this little sun chart, is actually what you'll be required to submit when you want to apply for BETSI or other types of incentives. And what you'll find is that they want to know what your solar access looking like. So if you're building a building and you think, I want to put PV on this, it's great, it's important to make sure that it's a solar powered system. You got to have access to the sun. So if you have a big building nearby that's casting a shadow, probably not the best application. Again, if you've got, you know, like a big tree near your site that's a theme or an element of what you're designing around, may not be the best application. Because you block the sun during particular parts of days, and it can have a pretty detrimental effect on your system output. So in terms of sourcing's another big issue with PV. And where it has the unintended effect of jumping into how you do your designs is when you're designing your system, you have to design the systems flexible so that if the panel that you build your design around isn't available at the time that you are actually need to purchase and install it, you can use a supplemental or a similar panel on your project, have that installed, and then still achieve the desired goal that the owner is looking for. So unincented first cost for these systems, the ballpark is about $7 to $9 a watt. That's for just your straight meat and potatoes, rooftop style system. When you start talking about integrated, sunshades, PV glazing, things like that, it just starts at $10 and goes up. So you get into the discussion on the building integrated side of things, almost always, which pocket is the cost going to come out of? Is it going to come out of the PV? Is it going to come out of the shading system or fascia cost? So maintenance on a PV system. We've got our little Maytag guy up there. Maintenance on PV systems, they're pretty robust, pretty dependable. What you'll find with them is the single greatest fail point, and by this chart and the research that's been done associated with it, is inverters. Inverters are the greatest fail point in the PV system. So how does that affect your design? When you're doing designs, you need to ask the question, if reliability is really important to this system, then maybe you want to go with multiple inverters so that if one inverter fails, you can still keep your system partially running. In terms of general maintenance, you want to make sure that you wash them off, and you want to make sure and check the output. That is the single most important thing to do on a PV system, because that tells you if this PV system is healthy or not. And there's actually some software that you can get with some of these inverters that will send you a notification if things are going wrong with the inverter, and that's a pretty useful tool. General safety methods when you're working around PV, it's important to remember that PV is, this, if it's got sunlight on it, it's hot. So you either need to disconnect the negative lead or you need to cover up the panel whenever you're working or you're around those systems. So solar one.
Let's do this.
With the problems with the inverter, is that historical? Because I know the new ones, they have a pretty good guarantee on them now, don't they? 10 years or more?
10 years or more. The average warranties typically now are about 10 years. You can buy some with extended warranties, but it's still the greatest fail point on the system.
Even with the newer ones.
Even with the new ones. Because basically what it amounts to is with a typical system, you're gonna have it's a glass sandwich with a PV in the middle. So where the system will fail is where, you know, the seals fail, you get moisture into the panel, it corrodes the bussing, and the panel itself dies. So it's still the greatest point of failure.
Solar water heating systems. So two projects we've done in the near past is University of Oregon and Willamette University. There's basically two types of solar water heating systems. There's a glycol system and a drainback system. Both of them are primarily for freeze protection, although they also are used, the drainback system, for capacity control. Some of the economics with regards to solar water heating systems is they are also incentive dependent unless you have a constant use profile. What I mean by that is if you don't have a building that has a lot of showers or a swimming pool or something like that, you don't have a constant demand through the part of the year when the sun's shining, you don't get the energy savings from those systems. So a typical payback, 8 to 15 years, but if you have a building that's not being used, like on a campus, that's not a dorm building in the latter part of the summer, you can have really extended paybacks. Maintenance, pretty minimal maintenance, wash down the panels. Interior components are similar to any other domestic water heating systems. They have pumps and mixing valves and so forth. This actually captured this out of red screen. This is just a spreadsheet for Portland, and it shows that this is the area when you get the most generation from your panels. So you can see if in June, July, and August there was nobody in your building to use the hot water, you'd lose a good chunk of your annual production. Wait, actually I want to hit one more point here. Mm-hmm. One of the things that we found happening is talking about the load profiles critical for overheating. At the University of Oregon, originally when we designed the system, there was an intent that the building was going to be fully occupied throughout the summer. But then for the first year of occupation, there was a lot of people not in the building for 2 or 3 months at a time, or a very small amount. And then what happened was that the solar water heating system kept generating hot water, but there was no use. So the tank temperature elevated, and we had to then start doing some type of safety. Otherwise, the temperature got up over almost a flash point. It was up to 200 degrees. So we had to add some safeties into the system, and the reason why we had to do that is there's a mixing valve that delivers tempered water to the showers, and those mixing valves are usually set at a minimum of or a maximum of 150 degrees. So the water temperature is really getting elevated, and everybody is getting concerned. We ended up retrofitting a bunch of additional controls into the system to try to reject some of the heat at night to the night sky. So it's something to be very aware of when you're designing the systems. Make sure the loads are real, and that you can have a way of dealing with them.
All right, so biomass, electrical generation. So the particular system that you're looking here is a product by Community Power Corporation called Biomax. And these guys are pretty much the leaders right now in this particular segment of the market. There's another company called AgriPower that has a similar type product, but it's much larger in size. So you can get a feel for beginnings of the sizes that these systems were offered in. I think when the 50 and the 100, those systems actually require a splash of diesel in order to get them started and make them function properly. So in these systems, the basic walkthrough of what the system is and how it works is you'll take your biomass. Typically with the community power product, it's traditionally been wood chips. You can use pellets, wood pellets, you can use corn, you can use other types of biomass, but when you do that, you need to be aware of the fact that there's going to be a little bit of a learning curve with the manufacturer and your particular client as they adjust the actual gasification process to maximize the efficiency for the particular biomass, because different biomass is going to have different moisture content, it's going to burn differently, and so there'll have to be some minor adjustments that, will take place over the initial months of the installation to get that refined. So your biomass starts out, in this case it goes through a dryer module, and then it goes through a feeder, is dropped into the top of the gasification module where their process renders it into a gas, and then basically it goes to your standard natural gas, or propane actually, generator. And that gas is then used, it generates the electricity. One of the other things about these systems is that they're primarily for baseload applications. And you're going to see that as we get into some of the other systems as well. So what these systems want to do is they want to turn on, they want to run at a predetermined set output, and they want to turn off. They're not really designed to start chasing load. When you start trying if you're trying to go for a net zero application or something along those lines, what you're going to want to do with these systems is you're going to want to design them to go up, run at your base load, and then if you need to have a supplemental power source, maybe that's where you look at other methods and ways of getting to that, like PV and net metering, and trying to take advantage of the ability of the grid to absorb some of those fluctuations in your power. So operation and maintenance on these, that's the critical element in these systems. So just to kind of walk you through how the system basically works is your feed into the top portion there. This is your gasification module, which basically is the old World War II era burn barrel. So what happens is the material stockpiles on top, there's a flame at the bottom, the material burns, it's in a low oxygen environment, and it creates a gas, a biogas, if you will. And that gas then is run across to these series of bag filters over here that filter out the particulate matter. That particulate matter then the gas is routed around. You can have modules in here that pull some of the heat off, and that heat can go back and be used in the drying cycle for your original material. And then basically the gas goes across into your genset, and you can capture some of the heat there. So there's actually two places to capture heat in the system. The ash disposal is one of the more critical elements of this system, one of the more maintenance-intensive parts of this system. Biomax systems in general you're going to want someone on-site to do maintenance for these systems. They're not going to require a ton of daily attention, but they will require daily attention. They will require someone to kind of wake them up, make sure that they're running properly. If an alarm goes off or something like that, people can kind of go and check it out. They've done a really good job of providing software with these that actually manages the system itself, and if it senses an alert or something that would be damaging to the system, it'll self-shut down, which is a nice feature of this particular system. Ash disposal is about 1% by volume. Where and how that happens is they basically have a 55-gallon drum out the back that's sealed that you just have to empty about every 2 to 3 days, depending on how much you're burning. So in general inspection, basically walking it through. Beyond that, it basically, the general maintenance is pretty similar to if you're running a generator in a prime application. You need to change the oil, periodically do overhauls. The other element about it is there's grates. They have little fingers that are used to kind of filter out and grab some of the char. Those periodically have to be replaced as well. So cost in these systems. Typically, the cost in this particular application was about $135,000 for a 25 kW unit. So on these systems, quite honestly, when you're looking at these systems, it's important to also be looking for grants because of the initial upfront first cost with these systems. They are dependent upon using the heat. You need to use the heat. You're going to see that with the other systems, the other combined heat and power systems as well, that the efficiencies, the paybacks significantly jump up when you're able to capture and use the heat in these systems. And then the other element that's important to keep in mind is the fuel. You want to have a readily available source of fuel. These systems where they've been successful, they're basically right next to a wood shop. They're right next to some source that is generating the wood chips that they use, or it's on-site institution that actually makes and has their own generation of waste chips, and they can use that to generate power. Again, as we mentioned before, the systems want to operate about 24 hours a day, 6 days a week. Take them down one day just for general maintenance and servicing. So CHPV, I'm just going to kind of...
Mm-hmm. Do you have history with that? Is that an actual installation you guys have done?
This is not one that we have done. This is the installations that have been done by this particular manufacturer have been more on a pilot scale. This is one where Community Power worked with the Mount Shasta Opportunity Corps to do that particular installation.
We did go down and tour it and spent a day there with the operators.
That one, I think it's been about
a year and a bit now, year and a half.
About a year. And we're actually studying. What drove all this is we were studying it for a project that Conrad will talk about a little bit later called the Story Mill Project in Montana. So combined heat and power PV. This is basically the old thermal solar collector. It's active. It moves in two axis. It has the advantage of basically what they've done is they've taken PV and they've laminated it on the thermal collection surface. And so the result is they're able to use a really efficient form of PV. So if your standard PV cells are maybe 20% efficient and your modules maybe 17 or something to that effect, these systems, they can use PV that's like 30 or 40% efficient. So you can get a lot more energy out of a much smaller amount of PV. So the result is it's a lot cheaper to buy metal than it is PV. And so that's where these systems generate their much significantly improved energy production for cost. The downside to these systems is this right here, what you're looking at. That's about 40 feet. The top of that's about 7 feet tall, and it needs to be on no slope. So it's in serious need of an industrial designer. It's just one of these things, and we've had the discussions with the manufacturers about these, but that's just where the technology's at.
Yes, sir. How wind-sensitive
are those structures? It's a good question. I don't know that I've asked that question in particular, but these are based out of Minnesota, so they've been tested under some significant wind loads and some significant snow loads, so they're fairly robust systems.
This is a project that we have been working on out in Bozeman, Montana. It's a lead pilot neighborhood. It's about 90 acres of development. It used to be an old story or an old flour mill that they're trying to redevelop into commercial and residential space. One of the systems we've been looking at on this project is a central heating, biomass heating system, basically like a university campus type central plant. The reason why we were looking at a central biomass heating plant is Montana grows about 2 million bushels of corn a year, and this particular project used to be an old flour mill. These are actually six silos that are on site, so we already had this huge possible storage situation for all the corn, as well as the corn being grown right next door. We could use locally grown biomass stored on site and use it to heat the site. The problems we found with it was there's very high first cost. This is like an industrial size operation. There'd have to be actual grain unloading systems similar to a grain elevator in the prairies, as well as all the mechanisms to transfer the grain from the trucks up into the silos and then from the silos into the plant itself. We found out that there would be probably the requirements for at least 2 full-time maintenance staff, maybe more. This boiler here that you see is a huge boiler. That's about 6 feet tall. So it's about 18 feet tall, 20 feet long. The other problem was is that in order to capture that much of Montana's corn, roughly 10% of their corn production, would be pretty tall order. I think there would be lots of issues trying to actually get that corn. They would end up buying it on the commodities market and so forth. This is a project we did about 3 years ago, Tillamook Interpretive Center. It's, if you take the highway out to the coast, right up by Lee's Camp, it's a kind of a cool project. You can see there's the same silo there, but a lot smaller scale. This project, we use wood pellets to heat it. And these three boilers are down in the basement of this building. And basically, the wood pellets are brought locally from Columbia City. There's also places out in the Dalles that produce them. We're lucky here in the Pacific Northwest. We have two of the biggest producers of wood pellets in the country. So there's lots of local source for the material. They're trucked to the site. They're augered off into the silo. And then they're augered into the boilers on an as-needed basis. This is all a manual process, so you need to find the right client that wants to deal with this process. The Oregon Department of Forestry had a particular interest in this system because it linked to the meaning of this interpretive center, which was to celebrate the Tillamook Forest. So they were very interested and stuck with us all the way through the design and championed it too, so that was it was a great project for them as well. Some of the economics to consider for this type of an application is that it supports the local economy, local pellet production. Here in Columbia City, most of the pellet production is from a byproduct of dimensional sawmills. So it's a reuse of a product that is not necessarily has a home other than for particle board plywood. The big challenge is the increased first cost relating to the storage and delivery. All that silo, all that mechanism and the delivery is all something that you would never have to deal with on a normal propane type system. Maintenance costs. Now, there's not a whole bunch of maintenance with these systems, but there is a daily maintenance associated with it. The boilers that we use and most of the commercial boilers available on this scale need to be manually started and manually shut off. They're not like an automatic gas-fired boiler system, so there's some challenges with that. The overall cost of the fuel works out to be very similar to the cost of propane. Some of the maintenance issues to consider are primarily the delivery systems. On the East Coast, they've had these systems for quite a while, so there's suppliers out there. Here on the West Coast, when we did this project, there was no one. We talked to bark blower companies, we talked to different companies trying to figure out how we're gonna get these pellets from the manufacturers onto the site. When we first loaded that silo up, we used a bark blower company from out in Tigard. It worked okay, but it broke up a lot of the pellets. Eventually, what we ended up using was a trucking company out of Tillamook that hauls cattle feed. The pellets for alfalfa pellets are very similar in size and density to wood pellets, so they had a good system already set up, and they come out to the site, augered it off. It works pretty good. They're still using that now. So I think as the demand for these systems grow, so will the support systems for them. The training of the staff is another thing to consider. These systems are definitely more involved than a typical gas-fired system. You have to go down almost on a daily basis and clean out the flues of the boilers. The boiler operation themselves is automatic. They have a small controller in there that changes the fire rate on them depending on water temperature. But there's still a removal of ash similar to the Biomax system. And it depends what time of year you're in. In the winter time, you have to take out that ash quite a bit because you're burning a lot of pellets. But in the fall and spring, it's maybe once a week you take out, you know, a gallon and a half of ash. I think we hit on the manual starting of the boilers. One of the benefits of these systems is they're as near to carbon neutral as you can get with a fuel source. You take this one, Jeff.
All right. So biofuels. We're talking about biofuels. Typically, they fall into really four different types that we were seeing on projects. The first is ethanol. We've got biodiesel, and then the straight vegetable oil and the waste vegetable oil, which basically really are just, it's the same type systems that are using the biodiesel. They just use some type of a converter in the front to convert this into a biodiesel type application, make the system run on it. The Sheezen project, which is this one we featured here, actually was pursuing a net zero energy goal. And one of the challenges that we faced on that was, okay, how are we gonna get there? And we basically filled the roof with PV. So, okay, we're in an urban core. Now we need a reliable source of power that we can generate all of our energy. And that's what kind of drove us to the biofuels approach. At the time that we started it, it was a real, we were really beating our heads against the wall on this one, because you talk to the genset manufacturers about it, and they basically would say, well, biofuels are great if you want to use them. If there's any problems with the system, it's your problem to fix it. So I mean, that was basically the consistent response that we got. We talked to the microturbine manufacturers. They basically said, you know, again, it's your problem. You're welcome to try and use them in our systems, but if you have any problems, then you'll be the one replacing the systems. One of the things that happened between that time is we had a significant amount of conversations with the Capstone folks, and then also, fortunately for us, the Army Corps of Engineers took an interest in this. And the result was that Capstone went back to the table. They donated some microturbines to the Army Corps of Engineers. There were some studies done, and now we have a product that can run biodiesel. So that's a pretty exciting development in this market.
And be warranted.
And be warranted. So it's UL listed, it's warranted. So the problem we ran into before is it's like, okay, you know, if you take your biodiesel through, it has problems with the pumps, you have to swap out the pumps. Now are you still UL listed? You know, have you voided your UL listing? So that was kind of one of the challenges that we were running into. But there's actually a set of parameters when you go to Capstone's fuel guidelines documents. They'll actually tell you the requirements that you actually have to treat and condition the fuel to so that the system will function properly. And if you do that, then it's a warranted system.
One of the other interesting things that happened lately is Imperium Renewables just got a plant online out in by Aberdeen Grays Harbor, so they're able to produce 100 million gallons a year of biodiesel. Their production rate isn't high enough yet. They don't have the stock, but there's a lot of local availability of biodiesel coming online for the Pacific mm-hmm. Northwest.
So one other thing that to bear in mind when you're talking about biofuels is they're sensitive to shelf life. So this is a system that if you're planning on doing a biofuel generation approach, then what you need to do is make sure that you're going to have maybe weekly fuel drops, or someone will come in, they'll fill up the tank, the system will run, because you don't want the fuel to age, because as it ages, it starts to oxygenate and you begin to have problems with the fuel, and it gums up the works with the systems themselves. So economics on these systems, typically we're seeing microturbine costs coming out in the neighborhood of about $2,000 per kW. Obviously that changes as you scale up. The liquid fuels turbine currently, I believe, is only available in a 30 kW size. I know that Capstone's got plans to make a 60. I don't know if that's been expedited by the Corps of Engineers yet, but that's one of the factors is the systems get larger, that cost will come down. Fuel cost is an important element too. That's, hence what the comment Conrad had made about having a large supply of biodiesel in our area now is very beneficial. These systems, the fuel cost, instead of following, the traditional oil fluctuation curves, it'll follow the agricultural fluctuation curves. So your fuel cost will change, and it will become important when you're designing these systems to get negotiated contracts for fuel delivery. So the systems in terms of maintenance, the main thing with microturbines is prime mover has to be replaced about every 50,000 hours. What that basically means is you're having to replace the turbine every 50,000 hours. So it's a pretty significant cost in the system. Fuel filter replacement is another element of it as well, coming in. And then I put additional biodiesel fuel requirements, and what that's tying into is things like you're going to have to warm the fuel. There's additional pumps associated with it as well. And so you get into the additional requirements, and we don't really have any specific information yet on that in terms of what that means in terms of operational requirements. This element here is a pretty key one with the microturbines. There is a support network available. So unlike the biomass-based system, the Biomax, where a manufacturer would have to send someone out to the site, they'd fly a tech out, there are actually people locally staffed through the manufacturer's representatives who can work on these systems and are knowledgeable on these systems. Yes, sir.
Could you clarify, you are talking about 100% biodiesel when you're talking about this?
B100, yes. Yes, and that's, and I've actually had discussions. One of the nice things about this is I've had discussions with our various incentive making bodies, and they do consider B100 as a viable source for net metering.
We're talking about the shelf life of the biofuels. It's like B100. It probably depends on how it's made, but what is the shelf life? Is there any stabilizers that are technology that's coming about?
I know they've got additives that they can put into it. I can't give you a number off the top of my head about the shelf life for it. It's just when you're talking about biofuels in general, the two most sensitive issues with the manufacturers are the shelf life of the fuel and the viscosity of the fuel. Those are the two things that consistently come up when we talk with them. So biogas, pretty exciting project we're working on with the lot administration and laboratory building. It's basically, we've got a wastewater treatment facility, and they've got their anaerobic digesters that are generating the methane, and then currently the situation is that they take about half that methane and they flare it. And then the other half of the methane they take to boilers, and it generates heat, and that heat is again recycled and used in the anaerobic digester process. So one of the exciting aspects of this project that we focused on is how can we capture that energy, and can we use that to generate electricity as well as thermal energy? So when you're talking about these systems, and inherently, basically the way that they work is you'll have your methane that comes off the source, it's captured in a pipe, and then you have to treat the systems. And that becomes the key element with these biogas systems. You can't just take the gas and then run it through your systems because it will cause premature engine failure. I mean, you'll have buildup on the interior components of the engines and they will fail. So treatment becomes a big issue. So what you'll find is the keywords, the buzzwords they talk about is you got the siloxanes, sulfur's another important one, and basically moisture removal. So what happens is basically you have your gas, it comes up through a moisture absorbing media, it then runs through a carbon filtration to remove the particulate matter, and then you have to pressurize the system. So where this gets important is with different systems have different tolerances. When you're talking about microturbines, they require a higher PSI, they require a greater degree of quality, less siloxanes, organics, and particulate matter. But they have the benefit of microturbines have less maintenance than the traditional engine generator. But the engine generators can run at lower pressures, and they have a greater tolerance for the siloxanes. So there's a trade-off that needs to be weighed there when you're looking at the different technologies for your particular project. Got a cost in here. These are kind of rough numbers from a recent project that we were working on, and we found was that the skid cost basically for the gas treatment was a pretty significant portion of that cost. So it definitely is something that needs to factor into the decision when you're looking at this type of a technology.